This is The Full Story with WSHU and WSHU.org. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. It's Friday, and it was a busy week for news in our region. We begin with gun maker Remington. The company announced on Wednesday it plans to appeal a Connecticut court ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. In March, the state's top court ruled that the families and survivors of the 2012 Newtown school shooting could move forward with a lawsuit against Remington. The company produces the rifle used in the shooting. Anna Radlett is the Washington correspondent for the CT Mirror, and she's been covering the story. Anna, welcome to The Full Story.
Hi.
Hi. Tell us a little bit about this ruling back in March by the Connecticut Supreme Court using this loophole allowing the lawsuit to move forward. Explain the loophole for us.
Well, it seems there is a federal law that shields gun makers from much of the liability for any harm their products, you know, can make. So, you know, if a crime is committed with a gun, somebody shoots somebody in the commission of a crime, you know, the gun maker is not liable. But there was kind of a loophole in that law that allowed for state consumer protection laws to have a role in regulating guns. Okay? And that loophole is what the state Supreme Court used to say, well, no, we're gonna overrule the lower court and say that this lawsuit can move forward.
How much of this has to do with the way Remington advertised the rifle and marketed
it? Well, I think the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, the Sandy Hook families and the one victim of the shooting that brought this lawsuit, they are going to say that Remington has marketed this gun as a weapon of war, and that it's also branded the gun in video games that are, you know, I don't know, I'm sorry, too much about video games, but video games that, you know, show a lot of violence, war type of scenarios.
So what do you think will happen next in the case? First of all, will the U.S. Supreme Court, do you think, even decide to hear it?
That's a good question. I can't read the Supreme Court. They may very well decide not to hear it, in which case it's a moot point. If the case goes forward, if the Supreme Court doesn't hear it and delay the case any further, I think what we're looking here is that the attorneys for the plaintiffs are going to use discovery, the process by which lawyers can get all kinds of information from the opposing party to find out just how much of a campaign Remington had to market its gun as a weapon of war.
Well, you also reported on Johanna Hayes, the U.S. representative from Waterbury. She was in the news twice in the last week. Hayes was the target of a political attack ad about the Green New Deal. Who released the ad?
This new group, I don't know how well-funded it is. It may not be very well-funded. It was only a YouTube ad. The group is called Project Freedom USA. Seems to be, you know, run by a Connecticut native and targeting New England Democrats. But this is part of a national campaign. Republicans think Democrats are vulnerable for their support of the Green New Deal. They say it's a very radical thing. They've gone out there and said that, you know, if this goes forward, you won't have airplanes and you won't have hamburgers and you won't have, you know, they've kind of stretched what the Green New Deal's aims are pretty to make it look as ridiculous as possible in people's eyes. So this is, you know, this is going to be something that's going to be part of many Democrats' reelection campaigns. They're going to get hit for their support of the Green New Deal.
Oh, that it seems to be working. The Democrats seem to be concerned in general about supporting this.
I think some of them are, some of them are not. It depends on your constituency.
Now, Congresswoman Hayes also had a heated exchange with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Hayes sits on the House Education and Labor Committee, and she went head-to-head with DeVos during a hearing this week over the issue of using federal funds to arm teachers. Why did it get so heated?
Well, this is an issue very close to Hayes's heart. I think it was her first piece of legislation she's introduced, is a bill that makes it absolutely clear, or aims to make it absolutely clear, that federal funds cannot be used to arm teachers. She's a sponsor in the House. Chris Murphy is the sponsor in the Senate of this legislation. And she's very, you know, concerned about how DeVos handled some requests from the state of Oklahoma, and then there were others, that asked, can we use this one pot of money that we get, one pot of money from one of the many federal education programs that seem to allow us great latitude in how we spend this money?
This is the Title IVA law? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, the Title IVA provision in the education budget. And she said, well, two things. The department said, oh, you're right, you can use it for a variety of things, but we can't tell you one way or the other. That's up to Congress. I have no authority. Congress has to interpret that part of the law, what the congressional intent was. And DeVos, was kept up with that argument at the hearing, and Hayes had an internal memo that showed that the Department of Education had determined that the Secretary of Education had the authority to say, no, you can't use that money to arm teachers.
So do you believe Hayes was successful in getting the response that she was looking for?
No. I mean, ultimately, DeVos did not answer, the question.
Mm-hmm.
Hayes had a gotcha moment, but she did not get a promise from DeVos to tell people they can't use that money to arm teachers.
Now, you've also been watching the Trump administration's judge appointments. In your article, you wrote that Connecticut was likely to feel the fallout of the partisan struggle to appoint judges. What do you mean by that?
Well, two things. More directly, appeals, federal appeals from Connecticut go to the 2nd District in New York. And right now that court is got a lot of Democratic appointees. But there are two Trump appointees that are up for seats in that court, and they could change the balance, they could influence how some of the cases that go to that court are decided. And then in the greater scheme of things, excuse me, I have a cold today. The greater scheme of things, the courts right now are blocking a lot of Trump initiatives. But as he fills more seats on the federal bench, the rulings from those courts could change, could be more friendly to his administration. And there are issues that Connecticut cares about that could be decided by some of these more Trump administration-friendly courts in the future.
Now, the Trump administration has already appointed one judge to the federal bench in Connecticut. Who is that?
Oh, I wish you hadn't asked me that because I forgot her name.
Well, there's one vacancy.
Yes.
We know
Dooley.
That.
It was Dooley, I believe.
Dooley.
Judge Dooley, yes. That was not a controversial appointment.
Okay, and there's still one vacancy. Any controversy over this particular post?
The senators, Connecticut's Democratic senators, say that, excuse me again, they say that they're confident the administration will pick somebody that they can agree with, that the administration will will consider their recommendations in filling that vacancy. Mm-hmm. So that is not expected to be, I should say, a controversial appointment.
And have there not been procedural changes put in place by Congress that allow some of these nominees to be pushed through quicker?
Not only judicial nominees, but all executive branch nominees. They're cutting the requirement that there be at least 32 hours of debate. They're cutting it down to 2 hours, so they can move these nominees through the Senate, which the Senate is always a slower-paced body than the House of Representatives. There's, you know, it's a great deliberative, they like to think of themselves as a great deliberative body. There's a lot of speechifying in the Senate. And senators won't get a chance to do that, won't get a chance to air their concerns about some of the nominees.
And so far, it seems that's been fairly successful in terms of the volume of nominees that have been approved.
Well, yes. And Democrats would say, well, you know, Trump is able to fill so many vacancies because when Obama put up nominees, Republicans who had the House and Senate slow walked them. They never got in before Obama's term ended. So you had these, you know, a lot of vacancies, and now Democrats say it's unfair that you're rushing all of these through when you slow walked Democratic nominees.
All right. Well, Anna, feel better.
Thank you.
We want to thank you for joining us, Anna Radelet, Washington correspondent for the CT Mirror. We'll be back after a break. You're listening to The Full Story. This is The Full Story with WSHU and WSHU.org. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. This week, a foundation established by hedge fund mogul Ray Dalio and led by his wife Barbara pledged to donate $100 million to help public education in Connecticut. The gift is at the heart of a public-private partnership to boost funding for schools. Economics reporter Keith Faniff wrote about this donation for the CT Mirror. He joins me now. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
This Dalio donation is part of a plan announced by Governor Lamont to raise funds for troubled public schools in the state. Tell me comprehensively about this plan, the education plan.
Well, I'll take my best shot at it. The problem is I don't know if anybody can tell you comprehensively because one of the criticisms is that it seems a little rushed. In fact, some people felt that they were a little surprised, not that the administration wanted to pursue this, but that they rolled it out when they did. If you remember, it happened on a Friday morning. There wasn't a lot of advance notice to the media. And then Ray Dalio discussed it that weekend on a 60-minute interview on Sunday, which had obviously already been taped. So it then began people's minds thinking, well, maybe the administration had to all of a sudden throw together a press conference because the Dalios basically gave him a heads up. Well, we already let the cat out of the bag, and it's going to be on Sunday night on CBS, so you may want to announce it soon. So that's why there's a lot of questions. What we do know is the foundation's offering to donate $100 million, and I know we throw around these numbers and people can say, how much does that really involve? To give you some idea, the state budget is $20 billion. So, you know, in a $20 billion budget, 10% would be $200 million. So this is about 5%, an amount equal to 5% of the budget. But it's not just $100 million you can use for anything. The state would have to match it with $100 million. And then the state and the Dalio Foundation are supposed to work to raise a third $100 million. That would come from other philanthropy groups. There are a lot of questions, though. It's, as you said, it's supposed to help help communities where there are high rates of poverty. But is that going to be focused primarily in the cities? Legislators from Eastern Connecticut, where you have a lot of rural poor towns, are saying, hey, is there a a portion of that for us. Not to mention, where are we going to get the $100 million of state money that we have to match this? There's some money in the budget reserve. The governor wants to take $20 million this year. We're going to match the $100 million over 5 years. But who's going to come up with that? And then what do you do in the, you know, how do you sell this to the affluent communities who are basically saying, so we have to help come up with the matching money, but do we get any benefit from it?
Yeah, let's break this down.
Yeah, raise more questions than I answer.
Right. Let's break this down a little bit. Management is essential with something like this. You're talking 5 years, not certain if you're going to raise the money, how the state's going to come up with the money. But oversight is going to be extremely important. Has it been determined who will oversee this?
No, there are so many things. What we do know is the administration saying certainly there'd be some oversight board. Certainly it would have individuals both from the public and the private sectors. The public sector representatives would have to include legislators as well, or their appointees, as well as the executive branch. Not to mention, we're about to enter the meat grinder portion of the legislative session. It's supposed to end on June 5th. And so I'm doing some quick math in my head. Basically, we've got about, don't hold me to this, it looks like 54 days, so a little under 9 weeks. That's, you know, they haven't done a budget. They haven't got toll settled. They haven't got marijuana settled. They haven't got sports betting settled. There are all these big questions out there, and they don't have a great track record of getting their work done on time to begin with. I don't mean to imply anyone's going to pass up a free $100 million, or I shouldn't say a free, but $100 million that's coming even with the strings attached. But it looks like it's going to be a scramble to the finish, and they might be looking at overtime.
Has Ray Dalio put any time limit on this, an expiration? If you can't come up with an oversight board and a plan on how this is going to be used, I'm going to withdraw this $100 million?
No, he's not. And to be fair, I mean, I could not imagine them doing that. There are certain things you don't dangle and then take back.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't imagine them doing that. Keep in mind, now we're talking about the Dalio Foundation, but it's not as though the state of Connecticut hasn't also put some money into other interests of the Dalios. I mean, we committed huge bonding and tax incentives in recent years to help Bridgewater Associates, Ray Dalio's hedge fund, expand facilities in Fairfield County. And they were going to, granted, they were going to both, you know, retain the jobs they had and create about 750 new ones. But between bonding and tax incentives, we're pumping like $52 million into the largest hedge fund in the world, which is a real asset for the state. But I couldn't imagine, given that, you know, anyone would even consider saying, well, the clock has expired.
And you bring up a good point with the bonding and tax incentive package that more affluent communities are going to say, we're paying, you know, more of that. And therefore, and so we're supporting Bridgewater, but we're not going to be seeing much, if any, of the money coming from this education plan.
Well, that's a good point. And it's not even, and I think you're right. I think you can even take it a step further. Not only are they unlikely to get any share of this $100 million, but they will be, you know, the wealthy in Connecticut will be the driving force providing the matching $100 million, which will also go into poorer school districts. And I'm not trying to argue against wealth redistribution. I'm just talking about the political challenge of selling this. But then you say, okay, but what about the existing programs? Well, we are already pulling back there, particularly in wealthy communities. For example, Governor Lamont wants cities and towns to pick up over the next 2 years about $73 million in contributions that the state would normally make to the pension fund for municipal school teachers. Wealthy communities, because they pay higher teacher salaries and therefore their teachers retire with larger pensions because the pensions are based on the salaries, will end up paying what are becoming known as the teacher pension bills. They'll pay the larger teacher pension bills. So you can make an argument if you're coming from Fairfield County that, you know, you're starting to pay more and more in taxes and get less and less back. That can make any type of political salesmanship very difficult.
Is that why the governor has taken an economic approach to his argument in support of this, saying 20% of Connecticut high school students are disengaged and disconnected, and that costs the state $900 million? Is that why he's taking that approach, that tack?
I don't think it's a bad approach to take, nor do I think it's an inaccurate one. I think the problem is, and now I admit I'm getting a little off the topic, but when we get into the problem with the state's pension funds, and I've discussed this on the program before, the big problem with our pension debt that we've accumulated over so long, and few people like to hear this, but the pension debt that we're expected to owe over the next 15 years is growing so fast, and people make the mistake of assuming, well, how bad can it be? I mean, can't we just, if we keep holding the line on taxes, won't the economy take off? And then that we can use to cover the pension costs. Again, how bad can they be? People find it hard to believe that Connecticut could have been that irresponsible, but our pension costs are slated to grow over the next 15 years faster than the best economic growth we ever saw. Forget since the last recession. I mean, in the, you know, certain boom years of the 90s and 2000s. Even if the economy were growing like that, by the mid to late 2020s, every year, the pension bills would scoop up all that growth and say, what else do you got? We still need more.
Yeah, this has
been the problem the state of Connecticut's facing.
And this
there's
is
really...
It's been a problem in the making.
There's no good root canal. You can't have a fun root canal. You can't have a fun fall out of a third floor window. We're talking about varying degrees to mitigate what is unavoidably a painful situation. And it's very hard for any politician to sell that. So they try to focus on, well, we're going to boost economic growth. They don't want to tell you it still won't be enough. It's going to mitigate the pain, but you're still going to face pain and probably a certain amount of economic deterioration.
And very briefly, before we say goodbye, Mark Zuckerberg made a similar contribution donation to the Newark school system, and that did not work out as many had hoped. Do you see that there's a possibility the same thing could happen in Connecticut with Ray Dalio?
I'm sure there'll be challenges. I'll just give you one quick example. Let's say there's not so much of a dispute over where the money goes. They can agree without fighting too much over which communities get the money. There's still a fight for, does all the money have to go for an existing program? Does it all have to go for a new program, or could it go for an existing one? Like, for example, you're some poor Eastern Connecticut town and you decided, we can't afford a French program anymore, a Spanish program anymore, no, a band program. No after-school soccer. And then this money comes in, and it's supposed to go to have all these new programs. And so somebody says, well, we want to bring these programs back. Or say you hadn't cut them just yet, but they were all on the chopping block. They're just about to go. And now this new Dalio money comes in, and the community says, what are we getting for it? Well, we're not going to make these cuts. From the outside, it looks like you haven't used the money. You're just using it to supplant local money. And so is it? Someone could argue, well, this is just going back to the taxpayer. And that's not what this was given for. It could be really dicey if communities try to use this money to lower their taxes rather than expand programs.
Much to be figured out. Keith, thank you for joining us today on The Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Keith Faniff of the Connecticut Mirror, CT Mirror, joining us today. Now, on Wednesday, advocates gathered in Hartford to rally support for a bill that would raise the age for purchasing tobacco or vaping products from 18 to 21. Jack Kramer is a reporter with Connecticut News Junkie. He was at the Capitol and joins us today. Jack, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Tell us a little bit about the bill and what it would do exactly.
Well, it would basically, very simply, increase the age from 18 to 21 for anybody to be able to buy both cigarette and vaping products anywhere in a store or anywhere else just raise the age from 18 years old to 21 years old in the state of Connecticut.
And why was there the push to include the vaping products?
Well, I actually think that's why, to be honest, I think the legislation is going to pass. Because there's lots of research, including Department of Public Health research out that shows the vaping usage among young people in not just Connecticut, but across the country is spiking at alarming rates. I think the most recent study by the Department of Public Health showed that as of 2017, which I think is the most recent study that they were done, that it had doubled from a couple of years before. And the issue of vaping and what it's done to not just high school age children, but frankly, middle school age kids, has what's given this issue so much momentum, I think, to probably pass in the legislature this year.
So you're seeing support for this bill in Hartford?
Yes. I mean, I think it's passed through the Public Health Committee in its initial stage by a vast bipartisan vote. At the public, at the hearing this week that you referred to, there was bipartisan support by both Republicans and Democrats. It's in the money that would be lost by not taxing those who would purchase these products is already incorporated as part of Governor Lamont's budget. The stars all seem to be aligned that with all the issues that are going to be difficult issues this year, tolls, marijuana, et cetera, my guess would be that this is one where, and the other, excuse me for backtracking a second, but the other thing that's kind of fueling this issue, just like the plastic bag ban debate, towns are kind of jumping ahead of the state on this. Several, Hartford, Bridgeport, Milford, South Windsor, I think about a dozen towns, and they're every new week a new town is jumping in, are actually jumping ahead of the state and banning the vaping and the cigarettes for those under 21. So the state's kind of behind the curve on this, just like they are on the plastic bag issue. So I think momentum is pushing this issue real hard for the state to get on board and take some action.
Is the state slow in acting have anything to do with the result in a loss of revenue if this bill becomes law?
I think that's probably part of it. You know, Connecticut has been criticized over the last couple of years. We're one of the few states that doesn't spend a penny of the tax that we take in for tobacco cessation studies or work. We've been criticized by the American Cancer Society and others for being one of the few states that doesn't spend any money on that. So, yes, I do think that is part of it. But I just think that the vaping issue has really fueled this debate to the point where everybody, regardless of the money issue, has just decided that it's time for, beside the issue of towns jumping in, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Maine, I think 11 states in total have taken action on this already. Every other week, another state's jumping in. So, again, I think it's probably an issue that's found the right time in Connecticut would be my guess.
And very briefly, we're getting toward the end of the session. Is it likely that this will be pushed forward to show something's being done there in Hartford?
Yes, I think it's, as I said, you know, there's going to be lots of debate and argument over tolls, over recreational marijuana, over lots of issues. My guess, you know, I could be wrong, but my guess is that this is one that's going to get bipartisan support. Len Fasano, who is the Republican leader, was at the press conference on last Wednesday urging and saying he's behind this issue. I'm guessing that this is one that's going to fly through and get voted
all right.
quickly by the Senate.
Thank you, Jack. Thanks for joining us. Jack
You're
Kramer,
welcome.
Reporter with Connecticut News Junkie. And we'll be back with the full story. This is The Full Story with WSHU and WSHU.org. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. In the last 2 weeks, Long Island saw new bills passed that could have significant impact on residents' pocketbooks and their environment. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo was in Stony Brook yesterday praising key provisions lawmakers secured in the state budget that he says benefit Long Islanders. Cuomo says a permanent 2% property tax cap will protect residents this tax season from the federal limits on state and local deductions.
In 1861, President Lincoln passed the first income tax law in the United States to pay for the cost of the Civil War. When President Lincoln passed the tax, he said the federal tax will be levied after state and local taxes. Why? Because the state and local taxes had primacy, and he was adding a federal income tax on top. So if you made $100 and you paid $10 to the state and you paid $10 in property taxes, left you with $80, the federal government taxed $80. It's been that way since 1861. What Donald Trump said for the first time is no. We're going to tax the tax that you paid to the state and to the county. We're not taxing you on $80, we're taxing you on the $100. So right now, you're not taxed on your property tax. Starting this year, you will be. So the property taxes will be going up. And that's why we want to do the permanent property tax cap to say to people, I understand that the federal taxation is going to raise the amount, but we're keeping it constant.
Here to talk about the permanent property tax cap on Long Island and SALT is Brendan O'Reilly, the real estate and features editor at the Southampton Press, the East Hampton Press, and 27east.com. Brendan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
The governor's statement that we just played there, is it fully accurate?
It's funny. This is the first that I had heard him doing the research of the very first federal income tax and all these quotes from Abraham Lincoln. It probably would have been smart for him to bring that up, you know, during the actual federal tax debate and not wait till now to dig that up. But, you know, as far as the 2% property tax cap goes, you know, making that permanent, I think that we would have seen that happen anyway. I would have been shocked, and a lot of people would have been shocked if it wasn't renewed again in this budget. The fact that they made it permanent, I think, was something that Andrew Cuomo had his eyes on for a long time, and this was the time to do it for a couple of reasons. One is the Democratic majority that he has in the state legislature they didn't have before, so they're apt to support his agenda. And two, you know, the federal tax law definitely lit a fire to create the political will to make the tax cap something permanent rather than something that the legislature has to give its okay to every few years.
Yeah, let's go back for folks who might not be familiar with SALT deduction. Explain that.
So the state and local tax deduction is something that people in high-tax states, especially homeowners, really enjoy to reduce their federal tax burden. So you might have your property tax bill, which for a middle-class home on Long Island, you know, you don't need to be a rich second homeowner or anything, just a middle-class homeowner on Long Island, to have a $10,000-plus property tax bill is not unheard of. In fact, it's common. And that's the size of the bill after they've already taken advantage of their state tax relief rebate called STAR. So if it wasn't for New York State STAR, that $10,000 would probably be more like, $12,000, $13,000. So you're talking about an area with very high property taxes, but one of the benefits when you go to buy your home, you say, okay, my property taxes are going to be this, but I get to write off every penny of those property taxes on my federal income tax bill and bring down how much money I owe the federal government every year. And then on top of your property tax being included in SALT, so is your state income tax. So that 10,000 plus property tax, you might be adding on $5,000 or more for a middle class resident of New York or Long Island just on state taxes. So state and property taxes. So when the federal tax bill came through, they decided to cap that deduction and went from being unlimited to a $10,000 cap. So for a lot of people, suddenly they're seeing no benefit, no tax benefit to being a homeowner anymore. So when you think, should I rent? Should I buy? Should I buy in New York? Should I get the expensive house? Should I get the condo? Do I just keep renting? You're going to see a lot of people not seeing a great benefit to becoming a homeowner anymore, and that's not great for the Long Island real estate market.
Will the permanent 2% property tax cap offset that? I mean, does it take the edge off that at all?
I would say it takes the edge off. It's probably one of these things that was going to happen anyway. Maybe it wouldn't have been permanent this soon, but I think that we would have seen the 2% tax cap implemented for a number of years going forward. The only thing that might have broken that up is if we suddenly had a year where inflation was very high. Since the 2% tax cap was first implemented in 2012, inflation's been so low. So your property tax levy of a municipality, and we're mostly talking about school districts here because they make up the largest portion of the property tax bill, their tax levy can only go up by 2% or the rate of inflation on their annual budget every year. Now, that 2% isn't a solid 2%. Like I said, if inflation's 1%, that 2% becomes 1%. But also, you run into things like carryover. If they didn't use their entire allowance the previous year, they could carry some of that over to the next year's budget. And there's also a growth factor. So if you have a school district where suddenly 100 homes gets built in a new spec house development, that school district isn't stuck serving 200 more kids with no money to pay for them. That school district can actually raise their tax levy to meet that growth. So the point of the school districts being allowed to meet the tax levy only or go beyond 2% only if there's growth in the tax base, what the state basically said to school districts and other municipalities was, we're essentially freezing your budget. Whatever you wanted to add on to your budget, you're not getting all this extra money to pay for it. We're going to allow you the inflation allowance so you don't have to cut things just due to inflation. But we're not going to let you say, we want to add 30 teachers, and somebody says, why? You have the same amount of kids that you had in the school district last year. If you want to add things to the budget, you have to show that your school district is actually growing and you have more students that need to be served. You can't just do these things willy-nilly anymore.
I know that Long Island lawmakers are trying to provide some help for homeowners. Congressman Zeldin says he wants to reinstate the full SALT deduction. That's going to be a tough sell in the Senate, isn't it?
It's basically a non-starter, is the case. he said, oh, I'll fully support Senator Schumer to get this done. Senator Schumer, he's the senator from New York, so he's obviously interested in this, but he also happens to be the minority leader rather than the Senate majority leader. So he really can't get that started, even though he has a support from a Republican such as Lee Zeldin. And also, it's one of those things that's probably going to have to start in the Senate Finance Committee. And even though President Trump signaled that he would be willing to open up discussions about the SALT deduction and possibly uncapping it or raising the cap, the Senate Finance Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, his office said he's not open to it. So if he won't even discuss it, you're really not going to see any changes made on the federal level. And it just seems like one of these things that people are going to have to live with as long as there's Republican control of the Senate.
And tell us about Suffolk County Executive Steve Ballone has an end run around this having to do with charitable contributions. Can you explain that for me?
So this is an idea that the Suffolk County Executive decided to take advantage of that started with a state idea that originated out of Andrew Cuomo's office. So as an example, you know, they set up a fund where you can drop money in to benefit the state, but consider it a charitable contribution rather than considering it paying your taxes. So if you were to pay $1,000 in 2019 into this fund, that becomes a $1,000 deduction that you could put on your 2019 state taxes. And then in 2020, now you could take 85% of that, or $850 of that $1,000, as a tax credit on your 2020 state returns. So this whole idea was designed to basically undermine the federal tax law by the state still getting its money, but now you get to consider your tax payments as a charitable contribution rather than as just paying your income tax and paying your property taxes. So because your charitable contributions are not subject to the new cap on SALT, you can now break that $10,000 cap. However, the IRS was not receptive to this. They need to make a more formal ruling on it to actually outright ban it, but the guidance right now is no, you can't do that. And interestingly, County Executive Ballone, what he said to the IRS was, you know, if you're not going to let us do this, we'll see you in court. He said that very confidently. Whether that confidence is going to be merited when it actually plays out in court is yet to be seen.
And before we let you go, our real estate industry leaders, what are they saying about this change in the tax law? How is it impacting them?
So I come from the interesting area of Southampton Town and East Hampton Town, collectively known as the Hamptons, where there are a lot of high-end properties, a lot of second homeowners who are only here on weekends and in the summer, and even just your run-of-the-mill local worker has to pay an exorbitant amount to afford a home out here. So most of our real estate industry news revolves around the higher end. And what you hear from these agents that deal with these multimillion dollar properties is that a lot of the people on that end are really, they just weren't thinking about it. It's just, you know, they already knew New York State taxes were high. The fact that they might pay a bit more because of this wasn't going to stop any of them from buying their second home. But on the low end, on the middle end, which, you know, you don't see a lot of low end this far east, but definitely in the town of Brookhaven, even though I work in the Hamptons, I actually live west of the Hamptons in the town of Brookhaven, where homes are more reasonable, not entirely, but definitely more reasonable than they are the further east you go. That's where you're seeing it. That's where you're seeing people say, you know, if I'm not going to enjoy the tax write-off for my property taxes, maybe I'll just go look in another state.
All right.
Maybe the dream of staying on Long Island is done.
Brendan O'Reilly, a real estate and features editor at the Southampton Press. Thanks for being on The Full Story today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also making news, Suffolk County has passed bills that it hopes will drastically reduce plastic waste like straws and styrofoam cups. For more on this, we have Newsday's environmental reporter David Schwartz joining us. Hello, David.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about these three bills passed by the county legislature.
Sure. So you had one bill would ban most plastic straws on Long Island. They'd have to be, straws would only be offered at sit-down restaurants by request, and if they do provide them, they'd have to be biodegradable. Then another law would ban what we commonly think of as styrofoam, polystyrene, so those cups and takeout containers. And, you know, these are big changes that the advocates are hoping are going to reduce litter and reduce reliance on the single-use plastics that are in waterways and beaches and all around there.
And was there any opposition?
You know, the bill's amazingly passed without a vote against it. There was some concern from one lawmaker who brought up that he takes his kids out to eat and they need a straw to avoid spilling soda on themselves, and I guess the kids chew up the paper straws. I've heard grumblings in my own household about that, about the paper straws disintegrating, but the advocates of the change here say that, you know, they're always coming out with better technologies. There are different types of straws made of different materials that are more durable but still won't last for millennia like plastic.
They are more expensive, though. What are some of the businesses saying about this additional cost? I've read something that it's 10 times more expensive to use some of these compostable and higher technology or, you know, later renditions of straws, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, the alternatives to plastics and styrofoam are both more expensive, you know, 10 times more expensive. Some of the straws are compared to the plastic ones, you know, 4 or 5 times more expensive for compostable takeout containers compared to the styrofoam ones. And that's one of the things that some of the restaurants point to as one of the benefits, and that those additional costs, they'll either have to eat them or pass them along to the customers.
And how long do they have to comply with the new rules?
So these laws are going to go into effect January 1st. They're, for both the styrofoam ban and the plastic straw ban. And there is a third bill out there that it would, at county parks, as they get new vendors, they're going to have to phase out the use of single-use plastic, so the plastic cutlery and plastic single-use plates.
Now, I know a plastic bag ban has been put into place, and what are they seeing as a result of putting that ban in place in terms of its impact on the environment?
Well, Suffolk back in 2018 put a 5-cent fee on both paper and plastic, and they've done some research that showed it reduced the single-use bag consumption by 80%, you know, millions of bags a year. That's been effective. Now, New York State came in and a couple weeks ago, or maybe last week, time kind of flies now, the state came in and they're going to implement next March a complete ban on single-use plastics. So those bags won't be available even if you want to pay a 5-cent charge in New York. But that's a statewide.
And I read one report that said more than 1 billion fewer bags are washing up on the shoreline in Long Island.
Well, I don't think there. They say that there are 1 billion less bags, according to a study that was done in Suffolk County, from the 5-cent fee. But, you know, the defenders of those plastic bags will say most of them are not thrown out into the waterways or thrown out onto the street. They're disposed of properly and end up in landfills or incinerators here on Long Island.
So overall, it seems to these bills seem to have support and expect to be signed into law?
Yeah, that's the expectation out there. They really passed overwhelmingly. You know, it feels like there's a lot of momentum right now against single-use plastics and against litter. You know, you're seeing reports of animals washing up with plastic bags in their stomachs and some of the broken down plastics ending up in the food chain. So, yeah.
All right.
A lot of momentum here.
David Schwartz from Newsday, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for our show today. Joelle Schrock is our engineer. Carrie Frank is our digital editor. Our assistant producers are Christian Carter, Natalie Trafari, and Sabrina Garone. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Ann Lopez is the senior producer. Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Rebecca Saran. Ron will be back on Monday. And thanks for being part of The Full Story.